Welcome to Many Minds, a podcast about our world's spectacular varieties of mind and what we can learn from them. We feature conversations that shed light on the diverse ways of thinking, sensing, and being that are out there. I'm your host, Kenzie Cooper-Ryder. Thanks for joining us. If you wanted a petri dish for understanding metaphors, how they emerge and evolve and jostle with each other, it would be hard to do better than the world of AI. We talk about AI systems variously as coaches or co-pilots, little genies or alien intelligences. Some researchers claim that AIs grow, that they're entering their phase of adolescence. Critics deride AI products as slop and dismiss LLMs as a kind of autocomplete on steroids. What's behind these different characterizations? Which ones are accurate and which are unfair? And are our metaphors for AI mostly colorful rhetoric, or do they matter? Are they shaping how we understand, adopt, and ultimately regulate these new technologies? My guest today is Dr. Melanie Mitchell. Melanie is a computer scientist and professor at the Santa Fe Institute. She's the author of the book AI, A Guide for Thinking Humans, and she now writes a Substack by the same name. This episode is a bit of a companion to our recent episode with Steve Flusberg. In that one, Steve and I attempted a kind of crash course on metaphor and the human mind. Melanie and I sit down for more of an extended case study. How are metaphors guiding, galvanizing, and maybe deceiving us in the contested realm of AI discourse? Melanie and I unpack 7 of the most widely circulating metaphors in this space. We consider how these metaphors are shaping not only our everyday understandings of AI, but also law and policy. We also talk about the metaphor and analogy capabilities of AI itself. Can these systems reason abstractly in the way that humans can? Along the way, Melanie and I touch on AI-generated poetry, anthropomorphism, the original sin of artificial intelligence, the myth of narcissists, psychometric testing and its pitfalls, metaphors for AI that are a bit hard to spot, and the question of whether an AI has ever come up with a decent analogy for itself. Longtime fans of the show will know that we've had Melanie on before. We invited her back not only because she's an expert in the metaphors we're using for AI, but also because she's a voice of calm insight in an area that's increasingly awash in hype and polemic. Longtime fans of the show may also note that we're now celebrating our 6th birthday at Many Minds. That's right, the show launched in February 2020. If you'd like to support us as we recognize this milestone, you can leave us a rating or a review, recommend us to a friend, or give us a shout out on social media. Your support is always appreciated. All right, without further ado, on to my conversation with Dr. Melanie Mitchell. Enjoy. Melanie Mitchell, welcome back to Many Minds.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So one of your mentors, Douglas Hofstetter, who I believe was your graduate dissertation advisor, has described analogy famously as the fuel and fire of thinking. Do you like that characterization? Do you agree with it?
Yeah, I do. I think he also described analogy as the core of cognition. I think it's absolutely right. People often think of analogy or metaphor as sort of decorations or add-ons to the way we talk or the way we think. But really, I think it's been shown in many ways that these ideas are fundamental to the way we understand the world. And I think Hofstetter is one of the people who has really brought that view forward, along with other people like George Lakoff.
So I'm curious, you're obviously one of these people who take kind of a broad view of intelligence in the natural and artificial worlds. You think a lot about what humans are doing, what animals are doing, what babies might be doing, what machines are doing. Do you see analogy and metaphor as still uniquely human capacities? How do you think about that?
That's a great question. I don't know if there's a rigorous definition of analogy and metaphor, but I think of them as kind of on a spectrum where analogy kind of ranges from just basic categorization.
Okay.
You know, we recognize some kind of category like a house or a tree, and we recognize it in many different forms, in many different contexts. I think animals certainly do that. Babies certainly do that. But then we start to extend our conceptualization of these things. So a house can become even more abstracted And we have things like, you know, the House of Commons or, you know, glass houses. We think of having our idioms or trees being, you know, the tree of life and all of those kinds of metaphorical extensions of these basic categories. So I really think of it as a spectrum. And I think, you know, humans have obviously taken conceptualizations and abstractions much further than any other species. But I'm not going to say that we're the only ones.
Right. I see. So just to gloss what you're saying, so you see sort of like categorization and what we think of as analogy and metaphor is all involving similar processes of comparison, where, you know, like the basic categorization, you know, maybe a caterpillar has to categorize what are food sources or something like that. That's like the most basic kind of categorization, but that's really on a continuum with more abstract kinds of categorization, like house, as you mentioned, or it could be like, say, delicious, especially delicious dessert or something, you know, I don't know, something like that. There's kind of a continuity across categorization and analogy. Is that sort of how you think about it? Or
yeah, that's definitely how I think about it. You know, you could define analogy as seeing two situations as being essentially similar or essentially the same. And, you know, when we talk about, say, you tell me a story and I say, oh, the same thing happened to me. Well, obviously, literally, the same thing didn't happen to me because I'm not you. I'm not living in your body. But I'm analogizing. I'm saying that I had an experience that has something of the essence of your experience. And I think categorization, you know, this tree has something of the essence of this other tree. And it's really very much of a continuum between basic categorization that many species can perform and very, very abstract kinds of analogies or metaphors that even many humans wouldn't be able to do, but very creative ones are able to come up with.
Right. Hope is the thing with feathers, right?
Like, right.
What is that? Do most humans probably don't understand that. I among them, right? I mean, maybe I can sort of get some glimmers of understanding, but you know what I mean? It's like
right.
at the far end, some of these are so abstract that we could debate them for ages and people have. So then I'm curious to just hear what interests you about this topic of the metaphors we use for AI. Now, obviously, you've been thinking about analogy broadly for decades now in your career. So you have that kind of deep background here, but you've been a close observer of the metaphors people are using for thinking about AI, for talking about AI. Is this just kind of a fun butterfly collecting, or do you think it's something more than that? Nothing against butterfly. I love butterflies. Yeah.
I think it's something more than that because people are struggling with how to understand AI systems and what their role is or should be in our society. And different metaphors have different implications for how we think about them, how we relate to them, how we legislate or regulate them. And it's very relevant to think about and to understand how people are consciously or unconsciously framing these systems as particular things that we already know about and how that leads to extrapolations or, you know, characterizations of what they can or cannot do.
Yeah. I mean, the metaphors we're using is one type of lens on what our understandings are, what our attitudes are, right? Like you could also just look at the pronouncements of various prominent AI thinkers, but it's almost more fun and potentially more revealing to just look at these, as you say, conscious or unconscious ways of framing AI.
Yeah, and I think some of the pronouncements of AI thinkers are metaphors, even if they don't know it. You know, Andrew Ng famously said, AI is the new electricity. Well, that gives us a metaphor for a way of thinking about it. Cory Doctorow recently described AI as the asbestos that we are shoving into the walls of our society.
Wow. Okay. I hadn't heard that.
So those are two interesting ways of thinking about it and ways of, you know, imagining what the future is going to be like.
And they're very emotionally laden ways, we should say.
Yeah. That's the thing about metaphors is that they often bring in emotions.
Okay, so I think a good way to move through this space, and it is kind of a vast and still growing space, is to just walk through a number of the more prominent, more discussed or circulated, let's say, metaphors for AI. And we'll be focusing on metaphors for the technology itself, how it works, what it does, how people use it, that kind of thing, rather than, say, its position in society. So I picked out 7 metaphors. Most of these come from your excellent perspective piece in Science Magazine. I was hoping for each one we could just say a word about, you know, where this metaphor comes from, you know, who coined it or where it bubbled up from. And then a little bit about the influence it's had or how it's perceived. Has it been rejected or challenged or these kinds of things? So the first one is one that is so deeply entrenched that many will not even recognize it as a metaphor. And that is the idea that AI is an agent or a mind, in some ways like an individual human mind.
This, I think, comes from the so-called original sin of AI, which is calling it artificial intelligence. You know,
right.
John McCarthy coined that term, but there was kind of a debate at the beginning what to call this field. Another possibility that Herbert Simon and Alan Newell proposed was complex information processing, which is a different way of thinking about it, which doesn't involve the word intelligence, which connotes the notion of a mind or an individual agent with thoughts, beliefs, you know, desires, etc. And so I think that metaphor was baked in from the beginning, just even in the name itself.
Yeah, it is fascinating to think about some alternate path we could have gone on where from the beginning we just talked about AI in terms of as kind of a processor or something that connoted more mechanism and less mindiness, you know.
Exactly.
So do you kind of reject this metaphor outright? Do you just treat it with caution? I mean, you almost can't participate in a lot of conversations around AI without, in some sense, taking this metaphor seriously. But I'm just curious, what is your attitude toward it?
I think we have to be, you know, very careful there because we humans, of course, tend to project intelligence, mind, intention, what have you, onto non-intelligent things. We do that all the time. And in the realm of AI, that's sometimes called the Eliza effect when we take chatbots, particularly chatbots that communicate with us in natural language, as having desires, having intentions, having a self, a notion of self. You know, you don't think that Google Translate, which will translate your text from one language to another, we don't think of that as having sort of a self, at least I don't think most people do. But we certainly do with, say, ChatGPT, where it's talking about itself in the first person. It's using the language of intentionality. It's hard to not project that kind of mindness onto it, even if we know deep down it's not a human. It's not a thing that can have sentience or selfhood or its own desires.
I mean, this metaphor is going to be hard to overthrow. Should we wish to overthrow it? It would be hard to overthrow for precisely this reason that we have this kind of reflexive stance toward anything that could be construed as exhibiting intelligence or mind. I've been really interested in, and I'm sure this is something you've noticed too, as an observer of this field, I've been really interested in how attitudes toward anthropomorphism have shifted in different sort of quarters, right? Like it used to be that among people interested in animals, you know, anthropomorphism had to be avoided at all costs to be taken seriously. And more recently, there seems to have been a pretty dramatic shift where now people are like, no, you need to lean in to anthropomorphism. If you do otherwise, you're just buying into this idea that humans are exceptional, that we're fundamentally qualitatively different from other animals. So comparative cognition researchers have kind of moved in the direction of embracing anthropomorphism. And then people in the AI world, at least more critical perspectives in the AI world, have gone in exactly the opposite direction, where it's like, to me anyway, as an outsider, it seemed like the anthropomorphism involved in talking about AI, you know, artificial intelligence and so on, just went unchallenged and was just sort of taken for granted for a long time. And only more recently have people started to say, you know what, this might have been a mistake. Anthropomorphism is a bad thing in this space. So you have these kind of, it's just interesting to me how attitudes toward this term have been moving in different directions in different areas.
I think there's some of the similar debates going on in AI that are in comparative cognition, because people do talk about, I guess, leaning into the anthropomorphism in AI.
Oh, they do talk about that. Interesting.
And they see this notion of human exceptionalism as being unfair to AI. I've heard that kind of criticism where people who are kind of boosting AI being a mind.
Yeah.
Saying that, okay, people are rejecting this because they believe in human exceptionalism, not because of any other reason.
Okay, so maybe let's move to, we've got seven of these metaphors, so let's move on here. But we should say, I mean, this AI as individual mind, I mean, that's in a way the bedrock. And a lot of these other metaphors, I think, whether or not they explicitly are doing this, they're sort of reactions to the AI as individual mind metaphor. So the next one I want to touch on is AI as, or LLM specifically, let's say, as stochastic parrot.
Yeah. This one has gotten a lot of press also, you know, kind of the opposite of AI as mind. And this, I think, was coined by Emily Bender and some other people in a paper that talked about the dangers of stochastic parrots. Very early on, this was like in 2021. And the idea was that LLMs have learned from their vast amount of human-generated training data text to stitch together in stochastic ways things from their training data. And so the parrot part was sort of the idea of parroting the training data. No offense intended towards parrots, who are very intelligent.
Right. I know. Birds. That's a funny thing about this. Yeah.
But in a non-deterministic way, the stochastic part. And I think the dangers that they were mentioning included this kind of anthropomorphism of these things. I think it's not the right characterization for what these systems can do. Okay. They can do far more than just parroting their training data, although they do that in some cases. And I think that nowadays, most people in the field would not characterize them as stochastic parrots. It's kind of become this, I don't know, straw man.
I see. Interesting. Yeah. For a while, it was sort of a rallying cry among some of the harshest critics of the new wave of AI, right? It's people were like, oh, it's just stochastic parrots, right? It was sort of a dismissive refrain. But you think most of the field has moved on from taking this characterization too faithfully?
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, I think these systems, it's pretty clear they could do much more than parroting.
Okay. So the third one I want to touch on is Ted Chiang's metaphor of ChatGPT as a blurry JPEG of the web.
So the idea there was, you know, a JPEG is a kind of compression, and that large language models were learning from huge amounts of data and then compressing it. That's not wrong. I mean, I think they do that, but they compress it in a kind of way that is very different from, say, JPEG or other normal compression algorithms.
I see.
And they compress it in a way that makes it possible to process this data to create a lot of capabilities that are more than just regurgitation. So I think that, you know, compression is a really important part of intelligence, I believe, but there's more to it than that. And I don't think that compression is the only way to characterize what these systems are doing.
Let's go to metaphor number four, which is AI as role player, or I guess simulator, you could say. So what about that one?
Yeah, that one, I think, is mainly due to Murray Shanahan, who's a researcher at DeepMind. His idea was that AI is, these LLMs at least, are, you put them in a role. You know, you say, you are a genius mathematician. This is sort of the way you do prompt engineering. See, and here's a math problem, and they'll do better at it if you put them in this particular role. And even when they're chatting with you, they are playing a certain role. And other people have extended this metaphor to being like improv comedian, where it's kind of a yes and. You tell them, you say something to them, and they say, yes, oh, that's so intelligent, and, you know, go on. And there's been a lot of press on results from red teaming AI systems, you know, trying to make them do bad things so we can see how unaligned they are. For instance, there was a case where researchers from Anthropic got an AI, their Claude system, to engage in simulated blackmail.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was all based on role-playing. They put it in a particular role. They gave it a scenario, and it went ahead and it played the role of an AI system that was threatened to shut down, and it tried blackmail to avoid that, which, you know, could be the scene of various science fiction movies or anything, which I think is the cause of this, is it's, if you put the system in a role to play, it will play it, which is impressive, you know? It's also a very important way that people do jailbreaking of AI systems is they put them in a certain role. You know, you're in some fictional role in which it's okay to tell me how to make a nuclear weapon.
I see. Yeah. Sorry, can you just quickly say what the idea of jailbreaking
is? Oh, jailbreaking is when you formulate some prompt or conversation that fools the AI or makes it go beyond its guardrails to do something it wasn't supposed to do, like give you dangerous information.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, this metaphor is interesting. I guess maybe I just need to read the original text of this metaphor, this proposal. But it seems to me like it buys into the AI as individual mind and then takes it a step further. It's like AI isn't just an individual mind. It's an especially flexible, shape-shifting version of an individual mind. Because, you know, when you think of what are examples of role players from the human world, right? It's like, well, you'd have to be a really gifted, talented actor, or maybe mm-hmm. like a con artist, or like some kind of psychopath, right? To do these kinds of things. So to me, it seems like just a little bit of a leap from the individual mind metaphor. But do you think I'm misinterpreting it? Do you think that's not how it was intended?
I think, you know, when you say like a con artist or an actor, something, a human one that has a certain reason why they're doing this, they have a certain goal, they have a sense that they're playing a role that isn't necessarily the core self of them. Whereas I think for AI, the idea is that it doesn't have those kinds of beliefs or sense of self.
There is no core.
There is only roles. It's only roles. That's
okay,
right.
I see. Interesting. I wonder if there's a way this metaphor could be tweaked to make that clearer. Because again, for me, it's just like the pull toward seeing a role, AI as role player, as just a sort of more, a slightly more nefarious genius than than otherwise I would. You know, it's a pretty strong pull. So let's move to the fifth one, which is AI as crowd or collective.
Yeah. So this is the idea that I think it's related to the blurry JPEG of the web.
Okay.
These LLMs have been trained on data text from all kinds of different people who have posted things online, written things online, written books, other kinds of text. And it's kind of an average of all of that. Or it's the union of all of that, perhaps. It's some kind of combination of all of that. And people who do social psychology are using these systems as a replacement for surveys of many humans to show sort of what a survey of many humans might show, sort of the average or other kinds of statistics, just by querying an LLM and thinking of it that way as a population rather than an individual.
Right. The valence of this one is a little interesting to think about, right? Because at least one of the ways you hear people talk about crowds or collectives in cognitive science is, you know, the wisdom of the crowd. And I think some of the pieces that have proposed this metaphor are appealing specifically to that phrase, right? So there's almost implicitly anyway, a kind of positive valence here of like crowds are wise and LLMs can be wise in a similar way.
Right. But I think there could be a negative valence. You know, crowds can be very biased. They can kind of reflect the worst parts of society, and AI systems inherit those biases.
Right. And they can also just be, frankly, kind of boring, right? Like a crowdsourced work of art. Who wants that?
Right. Exactly. Kind of the average, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I heard this phrase describing AI, which is regression to the meh.
I like that. Yeah. I don't interact with a lot of, you know, AI generated content, or at least not that I'm aware of, except maybe in the form of student emails. But it does often have this very worked over generic feel to it that you can just detect. It seems like who knows whether I could actually detect it, but you know, it feels like it has this kind of meh quality to it.
I feel the same way about AI generated art.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like this aura of it. Okay. Metaphor number six. And this is one that I have to say, when I first read your piece in Science and I started hearing discussions of this, I was like, wait a second, is this even a metaphor? So this is the metaphor of AI as cultural technology. And it took me a while to fully appreciate that, no, this is an interesting metaphorical framing.
Yeah. So this is due to Alison Gopnik, who's a cognitive developmental psychologist at Berkeley, and she pointed out that LLMs especially are closely related to other what she calls cultural technologies like libraries or the internet or even the invention of writing. They're ways of taking human knowledge or human culture and making it more accessible, being a sort of user interface for human knowledge and human culture. So, you know, Wikipedia is a cultural technology, and the UC Berkeley Library is a cultural technology, and the, you know, the web. And so her view was that this is a better metaphor than the metaphor of intelligent agent, because it kind of puts it in the context of previous technologies. And then other collaborators of Alison, like Henry Farrell and James Evans and Cosmo Chalisi, have extended this to bureaucracies and corporations, right? A way of taking human knowledge and culture and via products or via institutions, taking that knowledge in a different form and making it more available. And yeah, I think it's a really interesting and useful metaphor. I don't see it as necessarily saying that AI systems are not intelligent. Instead, they're like bureaucracies or corporations. It's more like intelligence can have many different forms. Like what you said at the beginning, I'm interested in diverse intelligence, not just in brains, but also in social systems. And you could argue that there's a collective intelligence in these institutions that we build.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it's sort of a different kind of phenomenon. Actually, one of the places where the power of this metaphor as a competitor to the AI as individual mind metaphor, the place where this really became clear for me was actually in the podcast series that you did with the Santa Fe Institute, where you had Alison on as a guest. I think at one point she says, and I don't remember the exact quote, but paraphrasing, she basically says, you know, the UC Berkeley Library has a lot more information in it than I have in my head, but we wouldn't say that the Berkeley Library is smarter than me. That just doesn't seem to make, it's not the right.
She calls it a category error.
Right, right. And I was like, huh, yeah, that's right. AI systems do have a lot of information at their fingertips. That's probably not a good metaphor if we want to avoid the AI as mind. But anyway, they seem to have access to a lot of information, but saying whether they're smarter or comparing them directly to an individual human mind just isn't the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think that's her point there.
So let's talk about one final one, which is the idea of AI as alien intelligence.
Mm-hmm. This is one that's also been quite popular because when you interact with these systems and when you kind of poke at them, they don't seem human-like. And I think I got this first from the neuroscientist Terry Sanofsky, where he wrote, you know, that ChatGPT was like an alien landed that could communicate with us, but we don't understand the nature of its intelligence and how similar or different to ours. The psychologist Mike Frank at Stanford talked about sort of riffed on this in a piece that he wrote, where he said, well, it's an alien intelligence. We know how to probe alien intelligences here in the biological world, like animals and babies.
Right.
We don't quite understand how they think either.
Yeah, this is one of these metaphors that seems really perfectly crafted to excite scientists, right? I mean, like what scientist who's interested in behavior, cognition, minds, could think of anything more exciting than actually having the chance to test and probe an alien intelligence, right? I mean, it's like, this is the stuff of science fiction dreams, right?
So right.
you can see this metaphor would have a lot of uptake in scientific circles. And I think it kind of has
a way
of stoking interest in the phenomenon. Okay, so that's seven of the ones that have been circulated pretty broadly and talked about. Are there any other ones you would want to call out as being important in this space right now? Or
so I think a lot of these overlap in various ways. Shannon Valor, philosopher, wrote a book called The AI Mirror, in which she said AI systems are like mirrors. She said they're constructed as immense mirrors of human intelligence. They don't think for themselves, but they generate complex reflections cast by our recorded thoughts, judgments, desires, needs, perceptions, expectations, and imagining.
Mm,
so, mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that metaphor. Other ones I've heard are AI systems are like viruses. They're like corporations. We already talked about that, that they're sort of this disembodied, fully self-interested entity that is ruthlessly optimizing its own, for its own survival. So that's another one. Yeah, it kind of goes on and on. There's many different metaphors. One other one that has been used a lot is the metaphor of an assistant. You know, they're being sold to us as PhD level assistants or interns or co-pilots. There's one. And even the notion of agents. People talk about AI agents. That's kind of a metaphor with the idea of something that has agency. And these systems, you know, don't have their own agency, but calling them agents kind of gives them that aura.
Yeah. There's the metaphors that commentators in this space, thinkers in this space are using. And then there's also this kind of other layer that we haven't talked about as much, but overlaps with this, which is like people who are actually just using the AI systems. How do they metaphorically imagine the AI? How do they frame their interactions, their relationship, this entity that they're working with? I don't know if you've seen much in that space. I did find one study just 2026 where they basically pulled a bunch of participants, having them generate metaphors, how they see their AIs. And it's, you know, there's nothing too surprising in there. It's a lot of AI as tools like Swiss Army knives, AI as powerful database or search engine, AI as intelligent teacher. Interestingly, there's some AI as child or pet kind of people sometimes appeal to these relationships that are a little more asymmetrical. Well, sorry, I should say asymmetrical in the opposite direction, right?
Right.
Rather than wise professor, it's something that I need to kind of, you know, tend to or watch out for. I'd be curious to see how the users themselves, how their metaphors may have sort of shifted over time. I don't know if there's been work on that.
I know the paper you just mentioned.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I don't know if there's extensive work on that. That's obviously a huge new area for psychology and sociology to look at. Maybe anthropology.
Yeah.
You know, it matters a lot how you frame these systems. If you frame them as databases, those aren't the kinds of things that can be your boyfriend or girlfriend.
Right. Exactly.
Whereas, yeah. as you frame them as intelligent agents, caring agents, they can be, you can have a romantic relationship with them.
Yeah. I love this example because I was thinking about just that, you know, I've been, as I'm sure many people have, and I'm sure you have, I've been troubled and thinking a lot about the rise of social AI and human AI relationships and AI friends, lovers, etc. I was just sort of thinking, if you wanted to wage a campaign, a metaphorical campaign to try to dissuade people from entering into these kinds of relationships, what would be the metaphor you would use to make it seem silly, trivial, or just like inhuman to do this? And I think, yeah, if you could come up with some punchy slogan around dating databases or something, it could actually have that effect. I'm of several minds about social AI, but it seems like there's a way of framing this that makes that whole upsurge of culture maybe a little bit misguided.
Yeah. I mean, Shannon Valor in that book, The AI Mirror, which I highly recommend, talks about the myth of Narcissus, who falls in love with his reflection.
Mm. Oh, I see. Yeah. Right.
And he ends up drowning because he wants to get close to his reflection. That's, you know, so close, uncomfortably close to people who have fallen in love or gotten very, very emotionally involved with their AI system. And some people have even, you know, died doing that. It's very apt, I think.
So yeah, maybe we can linger a little bit on this point that you make very clearly, that metaphors aren't just rhetoric. They do have these real world consequences. Obviously, we're talking about this, you know, some of these tragic cases of people entering into relationships with AI systems and then things go wrong. What about consequences for law, for policy, these kinds of things? What do you see as some possible consequences of the metaphors we're using?
The one that I've thought about is for copyright law. You know, there's a lot of lawsuits going on right now on copyright infringement, either for AI systems that have been trained on copyrighted materials. And often the defense is something like, well, it's just like if a human read a book and then, you know, used that to influence them in writing their own novel, that's not copyright infringement. So that's using the sort of AI as individual mind metaphor. Whereas if you think about an AI as like a library, if a library steals a book,
right,
that is copyright infringement, and you know, that's influencing judges in these cases. We see in the opinions that various judges are writing that those metaphors come in, you know, and they will come in if these trials ever get to juries.
Yeah, no, that's a big one. I mean, I'm curious, do you see a lot of the discussions around, say, AI sentience or moral concern for chatbots, do you see that as just sort of misguided extensions of the AI as mind metaphor? Or do you think there's sort of real important questions there?
I think there's a little bit of both.
Okay.
You know, there is some a lot of misguided things using that metaphor. Suppose that we take the role-playing metaphor and we say, okay, a lot of these, say, bad, immoral behaviors of AI systems that come out in red teaming are just due to role play. They don't want to, you know, blackmail, or they don't want to hurt anybody. They don't have any want. They don't have any goal. They don't have any desire. But it still could be harmful in the real world if these systems have these kinds of behaviors in the real world and we put them in charge of things and let them be autonomous.
Right.
If they're role-playing based on their training data, that could be just as harmful as if you had an agent that actually, you know, wanted to do harm.
So there are real sort of moral and ethical questions swirling around this, but not necessarily the kinds of questions that some people are pursuing. Is that sort of what you're saying?
That's right.
And then what about, I'm just curious about your attitude toward, you know, all these studies, it's like a huge field now, right? Comparisons of LLMs to humans on classic psychometric tests. Do you think it's interesting, or do you think it's just a misguided comparison because it depends so crucially on the AI as individual mind?
I think it's interesting because I think, you know, I don't know if AI systems are intelligent. You know, that word itself is kind of fraught, but they do have certain kinds of capabilities. Some of these psychometric tests try and get at certain kinds of human capabilities. And so it's interesting to talk about how we evaluate AI systems. I think people are a little bit too uncritical, unself-critical when they're applying these tests because they don't really, they just say, oh, here's an IQ test. Let's give that to Claude.
Mm-hmm. Right,
without
right.
thinking a little about a lot of important issues about evaluation and how Claude is very different from a human taking a test and the kinds of assumptions we make about humans when they take such a test versus, you know, a machine. But I think that also gets back to the issue of the alien intelligence. You know, people have also been somewhat unself-critical in applying these metrics, these psychometric tests to animals.
Right.
Or babies. And it just reveals our, I don't know, assumptions that we make, and maybe we have to be much more questioning of our own assumptions. And that goes for, you know, even giving some of these tests to other cultures, other than Western cultures, and making the same assumptions and saying, oh, you know, they did very poorly on this IQ test, but it may be issues that have nothing to do with intelligence or capability, but more just the way that the test is given.
All right. So maybe we can move now to the kind of second big topic I wanted to talk to you about, which is flipping things a little bit and thinking about whether AIs themselves are capable of metaphor, are capable of analogy. And this is really a bread and butter topic for you going back all the way to your dissertation. I'm curious, really, we don't have to talk much about your dissertation if you don't want to, but I'm just curious, like, what was the state of play back then? What kinds of things were you interested in this space back then?
Yeah, so you mentioned that for my dissertation, I worked with Douglas Hofstadter, who was very focused on analogy. And one of the things that he was quite interested in was looking at sort of idealized domains for analogy, for studying analogy. So he created various idealized domains, one of which I worked on in my project, which was called the Copycat Project, trying to get machines to make analogies in a sort of cognitively plausible way. It didn't involve neural networks or all the modern kinds of things that we have in AI now. But I think, you know, it was interesting to try and develop tests of an analogical reasoning that are still being used. People are still using the domain that I looked at. People are still using things like Bongard problems and Raven's matrices and all of that to test AI systems.
So you say these idealized domains. Could you just flesh that out a little bit for us? Like, are we talking about letter string type?
Yeah, letter strings problems? Or Raven's progressive matrices, mm-hmm. or what are now called the abstraction and reasoning corpus or ARC tasks. These are all very, you know, non-linguistic, often visual domains for testing abstract and analogical reasoning rather than more language-oriented kinds of examples.
So you mentioned ARC, the abstraction and reasoning corpus, and the work you've been doing with your team recently has been using that extensively. Could you just tell us more about what that consists of?
So this was a set of analogy tasks created by Francois Cholet. He used to be at Google, now started his own company. And they consist of, I give you a few examples of transformations on grids. So like I might have a picture on a grid of a square inside of another square. And then let's say a blue square inside of a red square. And then that gets transformed to just the red square, the outer red square. And then I give you another example where some other color of square inside some other color gets transformed to the outer one. And then I give you a test. I give you a green square inside of a yellow square. How do you transform that in the same way? So that's the kind of task, although that's a particularly simple one. But they're meant to capture what psychologists have called core knowledge concepts, like inside versus outside, same versus different, on top of versus on the bottom of, and things like that, you know, spatial and semantic concepts that are very, very basic.
I'm just curious about the history here. So they wanted to base them on core knowledge type concepts because they just didn't want there to be any question about whether you needed certain knowledge to do them, right?
Is that exactly? They wanted to be based on what Cholet described as innate human concepts, which, you know, people have debated the innateness.
Sure. Early emerging concepts, let's say.
Right. And, you know, he was very influenced by Liz Spelke's work on core knowledge. And that was sort of the prior that you come into this domain with. Objectness, geometry, topology, numerosity, but in a very basic way.
So, yeah, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing recently on this.
Yeah. So Cholet and some other people set up a competition for computer programs to solve these ARC tasks. And for a long time, AI systems were quite bad at it. But then last year, when OpenAI released its O3 reasoning model, the preview version was tested on ARC, and it did extremely well. Although it was very, very expensive computationally. It did.
I see. So sorry, when you say extremely well, you mean
it surpassed humans? Surpassed humans. So, of course, people made a big deal about this and said, you know, these systems are now better than humans at abstract reasoning and et cetera, et cetera. But my question was like, well, all you're doing is showing us the accuracy. You're not showing us how it solved these problems. Was it really doing what the benchmark was meant to test, which is sort of the ability to reason with these human-like prior core knowledge concepts? So we did some experiments where we actually tested on humans and we tested on AI reasoning systems, and we asked them both to state their rule for the transformation, like, you know, remove the inner square and leave only the outer square, like the example I was showing before. And we also looked at whether the rule that was stated, either by human or machine, was faithful to the output that it actually gave. And we found in both cases, these rules were quite faithful, but the rules from machines often were very, very different from the rules that humans gave, where humans did what you would expect. They talked about the core knowledge concepts that the tasks were meant to evoke, whereas machines would talk about very different things. They found all these sort of unintended patterns and what we might call spurious associations.
Right.
And they were using very often very complex unintended patterns to solve the tasks. They weren't using these sort of concepts of objectness and spatial relationships, so on.
Interesting.
You know, they were doing these tasks in ways that seem, at least to us, they were using concepts that were less abstract, less human-like in many cases. And so I think that just showing the accuracy alone masks a big difference between what these systems are doing and what humans do. And, you know, sometimes we want these systems to think differently from us, but sometimes we want them to think in ways that are very aligned with the way that we think, if we want to interact with them in various ways. And it's really important in, I think, evaluating these systems, not only to just say, oh, they were 85% accurate, but also to say, like, well, were they 85% accurate for the reason that this benchmark was meant to test, for some other reason? You know, there's famous examples in machine learning where systems use what are called shortcuts. You know, you give them a data set of skin lesions. This was a real example. And they're supposed to say cancerous or not and malignant or not. And they do really well. But then it turns out that the malignant examples all had a ruler in them. And they're using this unintended feature to solve the task. And I think that kind of shortcut, you know, just is appearing all the time in the benchmarks that we're testing these AI systems on. So I recently wrote a piece sort of exhorting people to use more kind of sophisticated or careful evaluation techniques than just reporting accuracy.
So is part of what was going on when you say that the AI systems were doing things in an unhuman-like way, is part of it that they were coming up with a rule that actually wasn't quite abstract enough? Like, in other words, other examples it got could have tripped it up. Like, it would have, you know what I mean? Like, it was too narrow of a rule. That was the issue.
Correct.
So it was finding these shortcuts.
So it's kind of correct for the wrong reason.
So these are, as you mentioned, these are nonverbal assessments. They were designed in that way. Like, given that what we're dealing with now are these language models, large language models, is it sort of disadvantaging them in some way to not give them sort of more verbal language-based assessments of abstract reasoning? Or I'm just curious whether that's another avenue that people are exploring, or is it would be too simple?
I mean, I think the reason for these nonverbal or non-language-based assessments, you know, they're a lot more likely to be kind of out of distribution for the models. Language, things have been trained on immense amounts of language and immense amounts of even demonstrations of reasoning in language. And so these were meant to be sort of, okay, this kind of thing is not going to be in the training data.
So in these kinds of tests, they're not forced choice exactly, but they're kind of fill in the blank, right? Like, some structure is provided for the human or the AI, and then there has to be, you sort of fill in the blank. Have people also been just looking at a little bit more open-ended analogy generation type things at all?
Yeah, I think there's been a number of studies on generating analogies and comparing them with the kinds of analogies people make. There's been some studies on creativity, you know, there's kind of these creativity assessments. And AI systems, you know, they can generate analogies. I have the sense, when I've been testing them in this way and like just sort of open-ended, what's a good analogy or what's a good metaphor for such and such? It's kind of this not that interesting result. I mean, it seems reasonable, but I haven't seen any like really new, compelling.
Right. No Emily Dickinson
things.
Style. Yeah.
And it's very hard to know what's in the training data and what's not.
I was thinking about this partly because I was looking back at this paper that I'm sure you saw about how humans prefer AI generated poetry. And it basically said one of the things going on seemed to be that AI generated poetry actually used more straightforward metaphors than the human poetry.
Right. It's like a lot easier. It's easier to understand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which sort of makes sense when we think about this. We were talking earlier about quote unquote wisdom of the crowd, but the wisdom of the crowd is often very bland and generic and whatever. So you haven't really seen interesting demonstrations of more novel or especially illuminating generation of analogies or metaphors from these systems?
No, I haven't seen it. And, you know, people are talking now about AI scientists and AI systems coming up with new ideas for science. Well, a lot of human thinking about science is using analogies and metaphors. And so the most interesting science often comes from very interesting, quite novel metaphors or analogies. And I think that's something that we're missing in AI systems.
So some people have tried to, you know, get AIs to sort of bringing full circle our conversation here, have tried to get AIs to come up with metaphors or analogies for themselves, right? Like, what is your, what kind of technology are you? Have you tried this yourself at all?
I did try this because I'm actually writing a new book about AI.
Oh,
and
cool.
I'm trying to explain, like, what are transformers? How do they work? And so I asked ChatGPT for some metaphors about what a transformer is. And it gave me some that were okay. You know, it's like an assembly line. It didn't give me anything that compelling, I have to say.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. In the series of posts that Bridget Nerlich has been doing on metaphors for AI, she mentions briefly that she did this, I think, a couple years ago now. But yeah, the metaphors that ChatGPT gave for itself were fairly generic, you know, Swiss Army knife, a boundless library of knowledge. I have a digital compass. Feels like it comes from the training data, probably, in a sort of washed out way.
Yeah.
nothing too exceptional there. Do you think our metaphors for AI are changing in any clear direction?
I don't know. I think that they're expanding.
Okay.
You know, I've been collecting these for a while, and I have an increasing collection of metaphors. But, you know, the ones that we talked about are still quite prevalent. And I don't know if people are moving along a different distribution of these metaphors. It would be interesting to see, you know, you could do some kind of like Google Trends analysis.
Exactly.
Looking at the way people describe these things.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how this plays out over the long term. Like, I mean, do you think there's some way in which we reach some point where we either all converge on a smaller set of metaphors, or maybe we just go fully literal? Like, can we just shake off our metaphors entirely and confront AI as it is? Is that is that the direction we're moving in, or what is the direction, do you think?
Well, that's interesting. This happened with quantum mechanics a little bit, a new science that people didn't fully understand, didn't know how to conceptualize. And there was this sentiment that was just, don't try and come up with metaphors, you know, just shut up and calculate.
Right. Interesting.
And so, you know, I'm not sure what the equivalent thing is with AI, but that's a very unhuman thing to do, right? Humans are metaphor machines.
Right.
And we're going to come up with metaphors. We're not going to just shut up and calculate.
And maybe what happens is the metaphors become so settled and baked in that we just no longer recognize them as metaphors. I mean, to some extent, that's kind of happened, I think, with the AI as mind, human mind metaphor.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine unseating that one.
Well, and that one's been, you know, just the fact that these systems use the word I and believe and think and want and I care and, you know, they use this language. That's intentional, I think. You know, that's a metaphor that's being kind of drummed into us just by the way these systems present themselves.
Another interesting turn I've noticed recently, I'm curious whether you've seen examples of this too, but when LLMs first came out, obviously they were radically new and shocking and had a very seismic kind of feel. But now they're starting to get a little more familiar. Enough people have used them. And so I've started to notice in at least a couple cases, people not just like comparing LLMs to humans, but comparing humans to LLMs. In other words, saying there was an interview with Jonathan Haidt, and I don't have the exact quote, but where he essentially said something like, you know, our kids are essentially LLMs. If their training data is full of garbage, their minds are going to be garbage, you know, that kind of thing. So there's been this.
Yeah. Well, as you well know, human brains or intelligence is always conceptualized in terms of the latest technology.
Exactly. Yeah. So this isn't the latest turn there. I saw someone pulled out from a historical archive recently. It was from a British newspaper in the 50s, but basically the whole article was touting computers as electronic brains, which, you know, it's like there's been this two-way street between humans and computational systems forever, right?
Yeah.
All right. So we've talked about a bunch of work already. Obviously, we'll point listeners to some of your articles on this, some of your Substack posts, a bunch of stuff you put out in this general vein. I'm curious, though, if you have any other readings or resources that you would direct people to.
Well, I mentioned Shannon Valor's book, The AI Mirror, which I highly recommend. Also, the article on AI role playing by Murray Shanahan.
Okay.
I don't remember the exact title, but I'm sure you can find it. And this article in Science magazine by Alison Gopnik and Henry Farrell and others called large AI models are cultural and social technologies. So those are my three suggestions.
Those are all great. And the Farrell article is interesting because it's the, you know, Alison's metaphor of AI as social and cultural technologies goes back, I think she started using that metaphor a couple of years earlier. And it feels like it took a slight turn in that article where it's more about bureaucracies and markets and these kinds of things. And I'm still kind of processing, how are those different from libraries? And is one of these versions of the AI as cultural technology metaphor maybe better, or are they feel a little different to me, but anyhow.
Yeah.
All right, Melanie, thank you so much. This was fun.
Thanks, Kenzie.
The Many Minds podcast is a project of the Diverse Intelligences Summer Institute, which is made possible by a generous grant from the John Templeton Foundation to Indiana University. I'm Kenzie Cooper-Reiter. Thanks so much for listening.